that because they told me at dinner. But you new folks, I'm kind of right ahead of you. And some of the older guys like to listen, too, just to find out if AA is still working. This is one of my favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group's the Fresh Air Group of Ocean City, Maryland. We're a big book study on Tuesday nights. Meet from 8 to 9 o'clock. If you're ever in Ocean City, look up the Fresh Air Group. We were named. It was the first non-smoking meeting some 38 years ago. Not very original with the name, but it is what it is. I've had two sponsors. My first sponsor was a man named Jim M. He had a sponsor. His name was Clarence Snyder, who had a sponsor named Dr. Bob Smith. I'm now sponsored by a man named Roger McMahon. He'd be mad if I didn't tell you his name. In case you ever in the Ocean City, Bethany area need to get a hold of somebody, you can find him in the phone book. He's also been in the hospital a couple times in the last year, and he likes when people come visit him from our fellowship, and it's real hard to find a Roger M. We're also not anonymous from each other. But Roger was sponsored by a woman named Geraldine Delaney up at the Alina Lodge, if anybody's. We've had some great history here tonight, and I love the history. I like knowing where I came from and what I have. Some of my current experience with Alcoholics Anonymous is sometimes our wonderful program, it sometimes today gets like that telephone game that we played in third grade. I don't know if anybody remembers that game where, you know, Bob's going to start with something. He's going to whisper it, you know, in Tracy's ear, and it's going to, you know, be, "The book is blue." And she's going to whisper it, and it's going to go right around the room. By the time it gets to the end, it's going to be, "Purple dragons fly at night." You know, I mean, it doesn't even resemble, you know, how this thing began. But this is one of my favorite jobs in AA. Right now at my home group, I'm a coffee maker. I'm pretty good at that, too. They tell me because they drink it. And that's what I like doing. I like greeting. That's one of my favorite jobs. But getting to go places and meet new alcoholics and meet folks on the weekends and carry our message. I mean, how much better does it get? You're going new places and just bringing good news. And in case anybody's new, that's all that there is in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's all good all the time. It looks scary. There's nothing here that'll hurt you. It's all good. And I can't think of a better job to carry the good news to somewhere new, and I've never been to your state, so thank you for having me. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I came from a wonderful family. Neither my father nor my mother drank. No one in my family drinks. I have one little sister. Any genetic theories of alcoholism, I'm open to them. Our book talks, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't have any opinion. My sponsor told me he thinks I became alcoholic by drinking too much. I've just gone with that. We're fascinated with trying to find the root cause of things that we don't need to. Tells a story about a guy whose house is burning to the ground. And he's out front. The whole fire department's there. He's got the big fire department hose. His house is burning down. And the neighbors are out. Everybody's out. They're all yelling, "Shoot the hose!" And the guy's standing there going, "Well, hold on. We got to figure out how this thing started." You know, that's sort of how it is when we get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, who cares how the fire started? We've got everything you need here to put it out. And that's all I needed to know. Growing up in that house, my parents taught me some wonderful values, morals. They were just good, good people. In third grade, they took me out of public school to offer me more than they ever had. They sent me to what I now know is one of the top three high schools in the country. I didn't then. I was just mad. I was mad that they took me away from my friends in a school, and I had to go 45 minutes on the bus to a faraway school with kids that were rich, and I first found out that I wasn't. I found that out because third graders tell you. They're very good at just giving it to you how it is. I don't know that there's any such thing as an enlightened alcoholic, that those two words go together. If there is such a creature, it might have been Chuck Chamberlain, from what I could tell. And he talks about that there's only one problem that encompasses all problems, and that's a feeling of conscious separation. And there's only one solution that encompasses all of our solution, and that's conscious contact. What I was starting to experience, not knowing it, was conscious separation from those kids, my friends, and the people around me. When I'm separated from you, I'm separated from me, I'm separated from God, I have no idea I'm in third grade. All I know is they're calling me names because I lived on a horse farm and I had to feed the horses in the morning. They're calling me names like redneck, farm boy, telling me I smell like hay. Their names, you know, are on the their grandfathers' names are on the big buildings in downtown Baltimore, you know, Legg, Mason, all these things, you know, and the farm boys showing up. And I don't know the reality of it, but it sure felt that way. There was a kid assigned at that school. I don't know if you guys have this in Minnesota. He was an older student. His name was Reed. Reed's job was just to beat me up every day. He would find a reason to just lay it on me. There was an unwritten rule at this school that the older kids rode in the back of the school bus. The younger you were, the more towards the front of the bus. If you went to the back of the bus, that was another good way to get a beating. There was this hierarchy, and I was on that bus 45 minutes each way. Something fantastic for me happened at that school, and I can't tell you what grade I was in, if it was 6th or 7th grade, but some of the 8th graders asked if I wanted to skip last period and do some drinking. Now, I'd never skipped any class, and I'd never done any drinking, and I said, you bet, as if I'd been doing it forever. And they said, what do you drink? And I don't know where this came from, but I said, bourbon. I have no idea where I got that. And I wish that at that point maybe I would have known that I was going to end up in Alcoholics Anonymous and talking to people like you, and I could have saved myself some embarrassment. The bad news is I didn't have bourbon. I had peach schnapps. That's pretty sissy, I know that. But what's important about this is what alcohol did for me, not to me, that makes me qualified to stand here with you folks. If you put enough alcohol in someone, in anyone, alcoholic, not alcoholic, it's going to do a lot of the same things. If you put enough alcoholic in a non-alcoholic, they'll eventually get sick. If you put them behind the wheel of a car, they'll get a DUI. If you put enough alcohol in them long enough, you know, the next morning they're going to be sick and hungover. If you do that for long enough days back to back to back and then take the alcohol away, they'll even go through DTs. Doesn't mean they're alcoholic. But what the alcohol does for me, not to me, and on this day, these guys, the first thing I noticed as I'm drinking this peach schnapps with these guys, I'd always wanted to hang out with them. And on this day, I noticed that it was pretty lucky they were getting to hang out with me. It was like the other way around. And that felt pretty good. The second thing that happened, I had to use the bathroom. And at that school, on the door, it said boys. And I sort of felt like a man. So that hit me as strange that I was going into the boys' room feeling like a man for the first time. While I was in there, another thought came to my mind. You know, that we will intuitively know how to handle situations. There was this girl on the school bus. Her name was Nikki. I liked Nikki, and I didn't know how to tell Nikki I liked Nikki. I didn't know how to talk to Nikki. I didn't know how to interact with Nikki. But on this day, I did. I decided I was walking to the back of the bus, and I was going to sit next to Nikki. So I came out of that bathroom. I start walking to the back of the bus. Reed gets up out of his seat to give me my daily beating because I'm crossing the imaginary line. As he's getting up out of his seat, I laid into him with everything my little body had, and he went out, cold in the seat. The whole bus got really, really quiet, and which I thought was like long overdue respect. I mean, it felt good. It felt good. And I sat down next to Nikki, and I'm looking at Nikki, and Nikki's looking at me, and I'm looking at Nikki, and God, it was a great bus ride. And we got to Nikki's stop, and before Nikki got off the bus at her bus stop, she leaned over, and she gave me this kiss that some of you guys will remember. I mean, this puppy was like half on the lips and half on the cheek. It was different than anything my aunt or my mother ever gave me. I mean, I felt it in my toes. You know? And I got off that school bus when we got to my stop. I went inside the house. I got sick. My parents obviously knew that I'd been drinking since they don't drink. I was grounded forever. I don't know if anybody remembers that. You know, there's no end in sight. Woke up the next morning in the bathroom where they left me, as sick as I had ever been. And the thought went through my head, you ever going to do any more of that drinking? You bet. You bet. Grounded forever, sick as a dog? What a small price to pay for what I had going on that school bus. I mean, are you kidding me? And it went on like that, you know, through the rest of high school, a little bit of trouble here and there. Turns out they don't like when you drive around with kegs in the back of a CJ7. No doors, no roof. You know, and my parents would come pick me up from the police station. Sometimes the police would bring me home. Every now and then my parents would teach me a lesson and leave me there for the weekend. So the consequences were getting greater, but in my mind, small price to pay. You know, weekend in jail, come on. And I end up leaving that high school, and getting a scholarship to play soccer for the University of San Diego, 3,000 miles away. I always liked growing up. I liked surfing, and I liked sports in general. Went out there that I could do both, and it was 3,000 miles away. I really, really liked that. And when I got there, I was assigned a lady whose job, this sounds so neutral when I say it now, she was just called an academic advisor. I mean, that's not threatening, is it? To me, it was. And this lady's only job was to try to help me pick the classes that could maybe, just maybe, get me through this school in 4 years. And it turns out this school was a Jesuit school. They had about 4,000 students. I didn't know what that was. I had no idea. I didn't care. And she's trying to help me pick these classes. And there's a funny thing about my alcoholism. Anybody in my entire life that's ever tried to help me, I perceive you're trying to hurt me. I think you're trying to hold me down and tell me how to live my life. You know, this is my life. You know, you've had yours. Why don't you just step back and let me live it? And what this lady told me, she said, you know what, being a mediocre student and a soccer player, you know, you're not going real far in life. You know, there's not a whole lot of professional soccer opportunity here in our country, in case you haven't heard, Rich. And you need to get some things on your resume. This is what I heard. I'm not saying it's what she said, that make it look like you're altruistic. You guys are big on that word. I wasn't real sure what she meant, you know, but she explained it. It makes it look like you care about other people. That I understood. You know, how to look good on paper. You know, I get that. What do you want me to be? What's the idea? And she told me at the University of San Diego, for 8 years, they'd been putting together an idea for, they wanted to start an Office of Alcohol and Drug Education. And they wanted this program, this Office of Alcohol and Drug Education, to be founded by a student and to be counseling for alcoholics, one student to another. No faculty member, you know, no authoritarian figure down, student to student. And Rich, we want you to be trained as an alcohol and drug counselor, you know, and you're going to be the founder of the Office of Alcohol and Drug Education. And this is going to look good on the resume. And I said, sign me up. So they did that, and they're training me to be an alcohol and drug counselor. I'm taking the classes that she told me to take. I have soccer practice in the morning with the team. I'm a team kind of guy. I like teams. I like camaraderie. I didn't know what I was looking for. I love during our history talk that some of our groups used to be called squads. You know, I like squads. You get stuff done in squads, you know. And, you know, we're all getting across the line together. You know, I get that. But there's another group of guys there. The thing I notice about the University of San Diego is the playing field's different in San Diego than it was back in Maryland. It seems to be about what you have more so than who you are. Back east, you know, kind of sports kind of got me through a lot. Out there, it seemed to be, and I don't know if this was true, this was just my observation. It seemed about what kind of car you had. The campus, you know, had the palm tree. I mean, it looked like Beverly Hills 90210. The kids all had their red BMWs and the girls, you know, and I'm on scholarship. I have nothing. The one thing I inherently knew, I don't know why I knew that, and that's that any girl looking like any one of you in this room didn't want anything to do with me if I couldn't take you on a really nice date. You know, I was going to need some scratch. There was four other guys that I immediately started to relate to that were there. They were on my soccer team. They were also there on scholarship. They were from Tijuana, Mexico, about 20 minutes away from the school. These guys each had lots of cousins just across the border, and they knew how to get this green stuff that the rich kids like to smoke. So now my life's getting even busier because I got this importation thing going. I got morning soccer practice. I've got the Jesuit classes. And from 7 to 10 o'clock at night, I've got office hours where I have to counsel you alcoholics. And then I got to drink about, by this point I am drinking bourbon, and I'm drinking about a half a fifth to fall asleep because my life's busy. I mean, if your life was like my life, if you had the soccer, the classes, the counseling, the importation, I mean, it's a lot. Our book talks about often the alcoholic lives a double life. You know, if I just had two going, I'd have been in good shape. I lived most of my life where if any two people that knew me in my life got together and talked, I'd have been in big, big trouble. You know, I had to keep mom away from sister, sister away from counselor at school away from my teachers. I mean, no two people could talk. That's a lot of work, you know, keeping that going. By the time I get to my senior year, I'd switch from the green to the white stuff because it's a lot more money. I own my own house. I lived at 423 Nautilus Street in La Jolla, one of the wealthiest counties in the country. I was the third house up on the right from Wind and Sea Beach, which is one of the greatest surf spots in the world. I was driving a BMW with a number on the back that told you they don't even make this car or sell it in the United States. They have to ship it here from Europe because that's how important I am. Like Bill talks about, I had arrived. Short three words that I knew exactly what he meant when he wrote that down for us in 1939, for a knucklehead like me to come along in 2004. That's something. One day, I was waking up. I was also dating, by this point, the most beautiful girl in that school, or at least that's what you guys thought, so I dated her. I don't know if I liked her or not. but it was about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. I was eating a bowl of cereal. The girl was next to me on the couch. Every single door in that house, boom, 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 came down. The flash bombs went off. I was in the plastic hog ties, the zip ties. Some of you have had them. They're less comfortable than handcuffs. And off I went to the federal penitentiary, the Metropolitan Correction Center in downtown San Diego. Now, I'd been arrested a lot up to this point, but it was all what I call drunk and stupid crimes. You know, I hadn't been in any big trouble. I'd had some bad stuff happen. Some of you that are here, I know and have, you know, been in a swimming pool. I have a scar on my stomach. I was stabbed in Panama one time. I was held down in Mexico by the people that I work for. I have an M branded into my shoulder just to make sure that I knew who owned me and who I worked for. And I had to do some other things to earn the trust during the course that I'm not going to talk about. But I'd never been locked up like this. And on the federal sentencing guidelines, those judges don't have a lot of discretion. And the newspaper, the San Diego Union Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, it said, Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. And I was looking at upwards of 40 years, and I was in there, and the significant things that happened, I think, were, and it's really the beginning of this thing we call awakening. You know, that's what, if AA was in business, that's what we're in the business of. We're in the awakening business. You know, I think that's kind of the, if there's an end goal, it's to awaken this spirit that we talk about. And we say spiritual awakening, and somehow when I say it the other way around, it seems a lot weirder and scarier, you know, especially if you're new. If I say spiritual awakening instead of an awakening of your spirit. And our book talks about, you know, if you flip to that back part, which of course guys like me don't do because we don't read the book, and especially we don't go where footnotes tell us to. That's like following directions. But it talks about this thing, all I'm really looking for, you know, is this radical shift in my attitude and outlook on life. That sounds pretty harmless. You know, maybe I could do that. So what happens is I stand up at the arraignment. The United States attorney stands up. He says, if Mr. Bruckner is given any bond whatsoever, he'll live a happy and successful life in Mexico. That was what I call a direct hit. An alcoholic of my variety, I don't respond very well to near misses. They go right past me. A near miss is that CJ7 with the keg, three guys from my soccer team, two girls in that Jeep. You know, I'm a senior in high school. We're coming home late at night from the bars down in Fells Point. I come around a turn, and that whole Jeep rolls, and everybody flies out. We're banged up. We're scraped up. Nobody's seriously injured. That might get someone's attention. I walk away from that. You know what goes through my mind? Man, I am a good drunk driver. Did you see that? I mean, that was good. I mean, it doesn't even faze me the way that my mind works. Doesn't clue into me, you know, that like that was lucky. Maybe there's something looking out for me. You know, I actually think I'm a skillful drunk driver, you know. I'd even argue with you in the bar that I drive better drunk. You know, we've all done that. So that struck me because somewhere deep down inside, I knew that I hadn't been happy and successful anywhere. You know, not in Baltimore, not out of the nice horse farm in Hunt Valley, not at the private school, not in San Diego, and certainly not in a federal penitentiary. You know, I hadn't been happy and go to Mexico. I mean, right. The other thing that happened while I was in there that I now see that was, it's what I call a divine setup, you know, when the universe is sort of conspiring against you and there's nothing you can do about it. But what happened? The universe put me in this place. I think there was 1,800 and some men in there. Every single one of them was innocent except for me. I was the only guilty guy in the whole place. And I know this because that's all they talked about all day long was, you know what, when I get out of here, the only reason I'm in here is because of my mechanic. If my mechanic had fixed my taillight properly, that officer wouldn't have pulled me over. And if he wouldn't have pulled me over, he wouldn't have known I was drunk. And if he hadn't been drunk, he wouldn't have placed me under wrench under arrest and searched the trunk. As soon as I get out of here, if I ever get my hands on that mechanic, you know, and they believe it, you know, and that's how I live my life, my entire life. And what happened as I was so surrounded by me, you know, and hearing these stories, you know, I'm in here because of my wife. If she hadn't talked back to me, I'd have never had to put my hands on her. And they believe it, you know, and I'm just listening to story after story. I knew for the first time in my life that I was where I was because of who I was, and that I was who I was because of how I live. I'm going to repeat that because that's a big deal for a guy like me, that I was where I was because of who I was, and that I'm who I was because of how I live. You all are big on that in Alcoholics Anonymous. All you really care about is what I do. Nobody yet has asked me what I think. You know, what do you think about our book? You know, did we get it right? You know, do you like how it's laid out? You know, what did you think about it? Did you think we should shift around any of the chapters? You know. My sponsor was pretty quick to teach me, you know, that right on that front cover it says that this is our basic text and that a textbook is a tool used for teaching and learning. If you look it up in the dictionary, a tool used for teaching and learning. He said, guess who's going to be the teacher and guess who's going to be the learner? That wasn't hard for me to figure out. He said, the other interesting thing about a textbook that you need to know, he said, you went to that elementary school. When we're in elementary school math, they give us a textbook. Has anybody ever in any class gotten a textbook where the teacher said, go home and learn it? They don't do that. It needs a teacher and it needs a learner. The other thing about a textbook is I don't get to weigh in. I don't get an opinion. It's not read it and tell us what you think. It's they say 2 + 2 = 4. They don't say 2 + 2, what do you think it equals, Rich? Right? And I get to go, well, I think 7, you know? No, it just is. You know, that's what a textbook is. It just is. I digress. Two guys came in dressed like me into that penitentiary, which I thought couldn't be lamer. You wouldn't have caught me dressed like this in a million years before Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that, you know, what could be lamer? My sponsor now tells me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have to learn to be perfectly square. He always does that. And he says, we learn to be perfectly square because if we start cutting any of the corners, we're back in the spiral of alcoholism. And that's like burned into my mind. But these guys that I thought couldn't be lamer, you know, I'm sitting in the back, I got the collar up, you know, I'm trying to be as tough as I can for a guy that's scared to death in the back, and I'm staring at these guys. And as they left, I'm going back to my cell, and a thought went through my mind, those two guys really got it bad. They can never drink again. I'm going to get out of here someday, but those two guys, they can never drink again. And our book talks about how the alcoholic, you know, we lose the ability to differentiate the true from the false. My alcoholic life becomes the only one I know, to the point where these guys are going home to, like, their families and a nice house and a white picket fence. I'm staring down the barrel of 40 years, and I'm feeling sorry for these two suckers that can't ever drink again, you know? I was in there for 1 week less than 9 months. The day before my trial, my case was dismissed. Two lawyers found out that the DEA agents that raided my house had some problems with honesty of their own on the affidavit to get the search warrant. There were some things screwed up, and I walked out a physically free man, but in no way a free man. I'd like to tell you I hot-tailed it to AA because those two guys carried the message loud and proud, but anyone that's been in the penitentiary knows when you get out, you're thirsty. And that started a period of my life where I absolutely surrendered to alcohol. If you'd have asked me, I'd have told you I was alcoholic. Told most bartenders that. I would put $20 on the bar. I'd say, this is your tip. Every time I need to ask you for a drink, you lose a dollar. I'm an alcoholic. Keep them coming. You know, I had no, and I just thought that's how I was going to go out. I couldn't go back east by this point. I had worn out my family. I'd taken everything from them I possibly could. They were done with me. I couldn't stay where I was because there was a lot of people looking for me for a lot of reasons in San Diego. Started traveling through, well, running. Sun Valley, Idaho, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Boulder, Colorado. I'd stay where I could. You know, I'd get a job bartending, waiting tables, you know, hustling. I'd stay where I was as long as I could until I'd eventually do something that I needed to do to get more money to drink more. and then there'd be a warrant. And guys like me, as soon as you hear about a warrant, you leave. You know, I don't walk straight through anything. I don't face the music. I'm a runner because I'm basically a coward trying to act tough. But I run. And if I did find one of you, you know, beautiful women at the bar, and we'd be talking, and I'd buy you a drink with money I didn't have, you'd say, "So what are you doing?" And I'd say, "Traveling, babe, traveling." You know, like I was some type of romantic sojourner across our great nation. But eventually it came to an end where I end up, we're all big shot, tough guy, wannabe. Drug dealers end up after the federal government seizes everything you have, and that was back on my mom's couch. And if you're laughing, you might have begun your sobriety on mom's couch, which, as it turns out, I've learned in AA is a great place to start your journey in AA. I couldn't believe my mother took me back, you know, one more time, and I was never, ever, ever going to drink again. You know, and I meant it with every fiber of my being, because there's only one rule at mom's house. You can stay as long as you want, as long as you got it. You don't drink. All moms have the same rule. That lasted about 2.5 weeks. She eventually had to get a restraining order. I wasn't allowed near her, 100 yards of the house. I had an aunt and uncle that had 3 daughters. They're my goddaughters. They had a restraining order. I had a tendency to show up at Thanksgiving because I was usually hungry. And those little girls would sit on my lap, and they'd call me Uncle Rich, and they'd say, "You're going to be here for Christmas this year?" And I'd say, "You bet. What do you want?" And she'd tell me, and then Courtney would tell me, and then Christy would tell me, and I'd say, "You bet. You bet." And I meant it. I meant it with everything I had, that I was going to be there. This year was going to be different, and I was going to be there with those gifts that those little girls wanted. And I wanted nothing more. And year after year, alcohol just didn't let me show up. And I told you what I do. When I don't show up, I don't call, because that takes courage. I hide. And they go on that list, that secret list of phone calls that we can't answer. You know, every alcoholic has caller ID when we get here. We don't have a house or a bank account, but we all have caller ID, you know. And there was a whole lot of people that I couldn't answer the phone for a lot of reasons. And that is, if you need to look at the phone before you answer it, that's a clue about bondage of self. It's living in bondage of self. And if you call me, one of the greatest freedoms that I have today, a lot of you in here do call me, and I get to talk to on a somewhat regular basis, I answer the phone, "Hello, Rich Bruckner." What a freedom. Doesn't matter who's on the other end. But I start coming and bouncing back in and out of AA. Something inside me said, you know, "Why don't you go see those people? You know, you've been sending them all there. Maybe you go there." And I'm coming, and in my area, they were telling me things like, "Hey, kid, keep coming back. Put the plug in the jug. Just don't drink. That's what you got to do around here. Put the plug in the jug. We'll see, you know, 90 and 90. You know, keep coming back, you know." And if I could put the plug in the jug, I could tell you that I don't need you folks. You know, I can't. That's one of the things. I've lost power, choice, and control in the drink. I was having a hard time with this. If you look at our AA schedule, I don't know what it looks like here, but, you know, Monday night, the AA meeting, it'll say Monday night, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, big book study. Open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, step study. Tuesday night, open discussion, open discussion, open discussion, speaker meeting. I could go on all week long. And there's also a spiritual principle that water seeks its own level. So I know I was looking for what I am, and you can't avoid that. So I was drawn to these discussion meetings where they were talking about things like the dog running away. I loved that. That was one of my favorite, you know. Like, let's talk about that, or, you know, what. And if it was a meeting, at some of the meetings, they would put the book up front. You know, don't do that, because the newcomers, if you see that, I'd get to another meeting, because I knew it wasn't going to be good if I saw the book right up front. And I mean, my favorite topic was like, you know, fired again. I lost my job. You know, I liked that one. Or, you know, she left me. That's always a good one. We love that one, right? The relationships, because we're all so good at them. Maybe the seats will be in a circle and we can go around. And I'm just getting sicker and sicker, and I love it. Now, there were people, and I stayed away from them. There was this one woman. My God, she made me sick. Hopefully you guys are going to agree with me on this. This woman was bad. Her name was Janine. And Janine didn't call her sponsees. She didn't call them pigeons. She called them duckies. Isn't that repulsive? And they'd follow her around, you know, and they all had the book at every meeting. Janine was sober like 20-some years, and she still had the book. I was like, you know, every meeting. I was like, haven't you read it yet? You know, don't you know what's in it? You got to bring it to every meeting. And there'd be six of them in back of her with their little books. And she was very clearly sober and happy. You know, you've seen these people. Y'all look like them. And, like, and I don't know what's wrong with these people, because when you remove alcohol from me, the problem gets worse. If alcohol was my problem, I wouldn't need you. That sounds weird if you're new, that if you're really an alcoholic, alcohol is not the problem. You know, in other words, I should remove alcohol, all of a sudden my job gets better, my relationships get better, the family's coming back together, and woo, life is good. You know, what happens to me when you remove alcohol is I start noticing things, like my mother can't look me in the eye, my sister hadn't talked to me in 6 years, there's all kinds of bills coming, the IRS is after me. These things really start piling up, you know, and that's this very uncomfortable place called sober. I don't like it there very long. And that's what happens when I'm not drinking and not changing. You know, not drinking didn't do it. I eventually get to where I have 36 days. Well, I'll tell you my last drinking story here. About 3 o'clock in the morning, I do a residential burglary on my mother's house, because that's another thing tough guys do, is we rob our moms, because you all look like you might hurt me. So she's got the restraining order. I break into her house. It's about 3 in the morning. I'm on my stomach. She sleeps with her purse under her bed in a house that's locked with a restraining order. So that tells you about our previous relationship. I'm on my stomach. I'm crawling across the bedroom floor like I'm in the army. And I'm reaching for the purse under the bed, and her eyes come off the side of the bed. And she catches me dead square in the eye, and she said, "Rich, take it. Would you just take it?" And that was another direct hit. You know, you could stab me, you can lock me up, you can do a lot of stuff to me, you can beat me up, but don't give up. Don't give up on me. And I knew how much that woman loved me, you know, and I just pushed it that far. She had to, self-preservation. I took it and kept me drunk for 2 or 3 days. Bill talks about that in his story. He says, when the morning terror and madness were on, I would steal from my wife's slender purse. And when the morning terror and madness are on, if you're between me and a drink, God bless you. It just means you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, not that there's necessarily any resentment associated with you. I eventually get where I'm with you folks for 36 straight days. I'm going to the 7:30 meeting, a noon meeting, and an 8 o'clock meeting at night. I'll make your coffee. I'll set up your chairs. I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And I'm dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I decide that I'm going to take myself out. Mostly I would look at the steps. You know, I knew just enough about them to be, like, dangerous to myself and anybody that might listen. And it was that fourth step, you know, where everybody kept talking about writing stuff down, you know, this written inventory. And, you know, in the world that I lived in, I already had the IRS. I just got out of prison. What I do for a living, the first rule is you don't write it down. You know, that's a paper trail. I've been living my whole life to avoid a paper trail. And I come to AA and you guys are talking about it's the key to our future. I'm like, yeah, back in the penitentiary, you know. I had my liver biopsied. When I first came in that first week, I was told that there were some fatty spots. But if you don't take any Tylenol, you don't drink. Tylenol is terrible for your liver. Lay off the Tylenol for a year. Don't drink. The liver and the human body are a wonderful mechanism. It's going to bounce back. At 36 days, I took as many Tylenol as I could get a hold of and everything else in the medicine cabinet. I just wanted out. The book talks about that, too. You know, I'm no different. It's just that jumping off place where I knew I couldn't stay one more day without a drink, and I knew that I couldn't have so much as one more drink. And I woke up. I don't know how this stuff happens, but what happened apparently was that I went down on the kitchen floor. And when I went down, apparently I crashed into the refrigerator, which smashed against this thin, crappy wall in the crappy place I was living in. And the lady, it was a Tuesday, the lady that lived next door happened to be home from work sick that day, and she heard a huge thud. She came out of her place and looked through the front door and saw feet laying on the ground in the kitchen and called 911. I woke back up in a hospital that I'd been in 4 times prior in the last year. I woke up in one of those paper hospital gowns. They're real sexy, the kind your butt hang out, you know? and I was hooked up to all kinds of contraptions, and things were beeping, and I had this feeling like, unbelievable, you can't even die right. You know, what a loser you are. I mean, when you can't even take yourself out right, it's bad. And then, to make things absolutely worse, is as I like got my eyes cleared, at the end of the bed, you all know who's there. Janine with the... And she's got the duckies, you know. And they're all lined up at the foot of my bed. Janine did not speak to me that day. She didn't say one word to me. But she did speak to those duckies. And she said, girls, I want you to take a good look. This is what happens to an alcoholic that refuses to take our steps. Let's go, girls. And they left. And I think that that snapped, whatever that last bit of resistance was. And here's the rest of that awakening. You put all of everything that had happened together with that last event, and something inside of me, I mean, it's not the wind and the breeze that Bill got, but it's a thought that is equally miraculous. The thought went through my head that if I get out of here this time, if I live, I'm finding one of those people with a smile on their face in that book, and I'm going to do everything that's in it. I don't do that type of thing. I don't listen to anybody about anything. I don't know where that came from. I'm going to find somebody with that book, and I'm going to do everything that's in it. Something inside me knew that was the only thing in Alcoholics Anonymous I'd never done. You know, I'd done all the other stuff, fellowship-type stuff. Went and I found Jim. And I told Jim this. I told him I needed to be my sponsor, and that I wanted to do what was ever in the book, but I was pretty sure, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work for me. I've been in it a lot, Jim. And he said, please be quiet. Somebody might hear you and actually listen. He said, you haven't done Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program of action contained in the first 164 pages of a book you've never opened. All it is 12 steps. That's all we have here. Nothing more, nothing less. That is Alcoholics Anonymous. We are a spiritual program of action with a support fellowship. All you've done is hang out in a fellowship waiting for some support spiritual program of action. You know, things might have gotten twisted somewhere along the way. And he was exactly right. He said, what you do is you keep seats warm for people that actually want to do the program. And be at my house tomorrow at 6. And I showed up at about 6 minutes after 6, and I knocked on Jim's door, and he opened the door, and he said, do you know what you are? And I said, late. And he said, no, you're selfish and you're a liar. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, that's what you're telling me. You told me you'd be here at 6. It's 6 minutes after. You lied. And why you lie is because you're selfish. What you're telling me by being late is that your time is more valuable than my time. It's okay for me to wait for you. Why don't we try this again tomorrow at 6? He closed the door. I learned in AA, if you're 15 minutes early, man, you're late. You are late. And it turns out that that's a good principle for life. You know, just being a half hour early, sticking around a little bit later. That has served me well. Very well in a lot of areas. We started to go through this stuff, and he explained to me how I had less power than was required to manage my decision to never take another drink. And that's what our first step was really saying. Nothing more, nothing less. Just turn the word around. What's powerless, less power? What can't you manage? I've made the decision time and time again to never take another drink. How well do you do managing that, Rich? Not very well. I had less power than was required to manage my decision to never take another drink. Told me I'd done the second step. I didn't know that. That was a shock to me. He said, you've come to believe in a great power greater than your... really? What is that, Jim? He said, well, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you keep coming back to us. You're not going to, you know, any more of those psychiatrists you like. You're not going to one more rehab. You're not going to one more... Why do you keep coming back? You ever thought about that? Why do you keep coming here? You obviously believe that there is a power here that is going to help you. Would you agree with that? And I'm like, well, yeah, I guess that is why I keep coming here. I'd never thought about why I kept coming here. Something inside of me inherently knew that there was a solution here. And he said, well, with that said, you know, would you like to make a decision to give it a try? That was my third step. Would you like to make a decision to give it a try? I always said I was working on the third step. He told me that you can't work on the third step. Told me that working on the third step is code. If anybody's new, I'll break the code for you. The old timers get mad at me, but that's why I'm here for you new people. When you say I'm working on the third step, what you're saying is I'm scared to death to do a fourth step. And they know it. And they know it. And when they come up and say, how you doing, kid, and they put their hand out, they don't really want to know what that means. That's code. That means what step are you on? How you doing means what step are you on? They don't want to hear about your day or the dog or any of that. They want to hear, where are you? You know? So there's just two code things for you. So I start writing this stuff down, and I shared it with Jim. We did resentments and the fears and the sex, and I shared it. And I remember that night. That was the night that I joined, that I felt a part for the first time, Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into Jim's group, and all those old guys were smoking their pipes and cigars and cigarettes out front. It's a Thursday night meeting called As Bill Sees It, and they're lined. It's like running a gauntlet of smoke, man, going through those guys to get into the meeting. And that night, I mean, it's how I imagine those guys on the NFL must feel when they run out through the tunnel of all their teammates. Those old guys are going, heard you did your fifth step, kid. Welcome to AA. Heard you did your fifth step. And they're patting me on the back. I mean, I'm like going down the line, man. It was like I was in, you know, for real. You know, our traditions talk about the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I get that. He pointed out to me that we have all kinds of members. We got drunk members, sober members, rotating members, lasting long time sober members, you know, weed smoking members. We got all kinds of members. You know, he showed me a paragraph that talks about, you know, what our program requires for its successful consummation. Who cares for the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which the process requires for its successful consummation? Hey, Rich, are you interested in being a successful member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Yes. Yes, I was by this point. You know, I had drank enough. I wanted to stick around and be with you people. At that point, he introduced me to Roger as I came up on 6, 7, 8, and 9. There was some stuff that he felt Roger would be better suited for. And this guy, Roger, I mean, what a great guy in my life. And he says that, and this will be the only foul word you hear me say from here, he says, you know, up through step 9, Alcoholics Anonymous is largely theoretical. He goes, all you are, after you've done all the time that you've spent on the first 8 steps, you're a very self-aware asshole. That's it. You know, nobody cares. You know, you've done nothing to set the record straight. You've done nothing to rub it clean. You just know a lot about your greater deficiencies, the book talks about. You know, I could tell you about what some of my shortcomings are. I might even be able to name you a few defects. You know, the world at large could care less that I now know these things. You know, and the book spends 2 pages getting me psyched up for this 9th step, you know, that there's still, you know, more action ahead. And he kept saying to me, his words that I will never forget was, hey, Rich, how free do you want to be? How free do you want to be? And he always talks about, we got all kinds of sobriety in AA, kid. We got everything from ground beef to filet mignon. What do you want? How free do you want to be? And I started taking my first amendment was taking my mom on a date once a week. He said, wherever she'll take you, wherever she'll go, you take her. Lunch, dinner, whatever. And I start taking mom out once a week. And I have this great, you know, job. It was all I could do at the time. I was sweeping the floor in a picture frame shop because my hands were shaking real bad. This guy, AA member, would make hand-carved picture frames out of wood, and it's kind of a lost art. He'd lay gold on top. It's called gilding, and I'd just sweep up this floor, and all day long we'd listen to speaker tapes, you know, Norm Alpie and Clancy, and shoot, I've heard Bob's tape so many times I could wear it out, you know, all day long, sweeping the floor, sweeping the floor, sweeping the floor. And then at night, his wife would feed me, and we'd go to the 8 o'clock meeting. And I made $5, I think $5.60 an hour. And something was weird. At the end of the week, I always had money left to take my mom out. You know, a little is a lot in AA. Something happens that when our focus shifts to the spiritual, the material is always there. And when I spent the whole rest of my life trying to get the material, I could never quite get my hands on it. A little becomes a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the first things we get is a pay raise. When we stop drinking and all that other stuff, it's a lot of money left over. Which I quickly had to start sending to the IRS. And we'd go to the mailbox, and I'd have to talk to the mailbox. You know, I would put in at first a $20 check, and I owed over $14,000, so I didn't understand why sending $20, it wasn't even going to take a nip at the interest. And he said, send something. That's what we do. And I would put that $20 check in the envelope to the mailbox, and he would have me say out loud to the mailbox, I am doing the ninth step to the IRS. And I would put it in, and I'd get it in the car. And I don't know. I mean, I'd always look for the AA over-the-counter, like, sleeping pill, you know, or something, because my first 3 to 6 months, if anybody's in that range and you're not sleeping well, welcome to my world. I mean, I would wake up with that sweaty pillow, and it's all wet, and you flip it over. I mean, it's just nasty. And you wash it, and that yellow ring never comes out, and you got to go back. You know, like, how do you all sleep around here without drinking? And there's no pill, you know. These old dogs aren't taking any pills. What they said is a clear conscience makes for a soft pillow. And that's what those $20 checks did. I started to fall asleep all night long. And after months and months with Mom at dinner, one night at dinner, her head came up from her plate and she looked me in the eye while we were talking. And I couldn't have told any of you guys sitting in this room that one of the reasons that I stayed drunk was because somewhere deep inside it was important for me to be a son and to act like a son. And to show up for my mom when my mom needed me, to change a light bulb or some other little thing that just sons do. And you all were teaching me to be a son. And I had no idea how important that was, but I was falling asleep. My little sister, she hadn't talked to me for 6 years. For some reason, I came to AA, I had a set of Ravens, Baltimore Ravens season tickets, and a plastic bag with all my clothes. Like, that was it. Those were my two earthly possessions. And I don't know where the tickets came from. I think that they were probably like the result of that like one last drug deal or something. So he said, send the tickets to your sister. He's like, you don't even like football games now that you're sober. What you liked was being the big shot in the parking lot and having a bar and carving a prime rib at the tailgate and making the drinks for everybody. You were so drunk by the time the game started, you never knew what happened anyway. And he said, just send them. And I said, that's stupid. She hasn't talked to me in 6 years. He said, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, send the tickets. So I sent the tickets, and nothing happened. And I told him, nothing happened. He said, send the next set. And I said, whoa, you know, one time that's on her. I mean, I do it twice. I'm the fool. And he said, send them. And I sent them. And I don't know what quarter of the game it was. I don't know what was happening. All I know is that my phone rang, and on the other end of that phone was my little sister going, did you just see that pass? They just tied it up. They just tied it up. And I was talking to my little sister for the first time in 6 years. And this went on and on. We started talking about football games was the level that I could meet her at with these games. And she would call and tell me about the games. And then she bought her first house down in the city in Baltimore. I had gotten, now I'm sober about, this is going on for about a year. I'm sober a year and a half maybe. And I'd gotten a new job. I was now vacuuming out swimming pools. And moving up, you know, and when you vacuum swimming pools, you have to do it like from 4 a.m. It has to be done by 10 a.m. because it turns out that people wake up before noon and like to go swimming. I didn't know that. So, but now I'm getting $500 a week, man, and I couldn't even believe it. You know, I'm paying the IRS a little bit more, and then my sister buys this house. I drive 3 hours each weekend on Friday when I'm done the pools. I drive 3 hours to Baltimore City. To help her paint the walls, to put together, to snap together hardwood floors. I'm not a carpenter, so don't anybody ask me for that kind. You know, and I'm putting it together. And what I'm doing is being a brother, and we're talking, and we're laughing, and we're having fun. And we're growing a relationship because I'm showing up on the weekends, whether I'm tired or not. I can promise everybody in this room there was never a Friday afternoon when I thought to myself, you know what'll be fun this weekend? I'm going to drive 3 hours and paint a wall with my sister. You know, there was never a good time. It was just what had, if I was waiting for a good time to do any one of my amends, they wouldn't be done yet, you know. But so this is going on. After about a year and a half of that, I get a phone call from the guy she'd been dating. His name's Justin, and he said, hey, Rich, I need to ask you something. He said, your father's not a big part of your sister's life anymore. He's no longer around, and you're like the most important man in her life, and the way she looks at you and thinks of you, I'd like to ask you for her hand in marriage. And I don't know what in the world made him think that, you know, a drunk like me is qualified to give away a little girl's hand that I was no kind of brother to for all those years, you know. I had a million thoughts race through my head. The only thing that came out of my mouth was, you do any drinking? No. Oh, but She then asked if I would, about 2 days later, she called, asked if I'd walk her down the aisle and give her away. That was one of my greatest privileges, you know, in AA, was walking her down that aisle and showing up, you know, and half hour early doesn't even cut it, man. I was there like way early. I was ready. And what a great day, you know, great events will come to pass. And that was one of them. And my next one was this guy, Ethan. Ethan was my childhood friend, man, from like third grade on. And he asked me to be the best man in his wedding. His father sent me a plane ticket to San Diego. This is while I was out in San Diego, taking over the world in college. And had a tuxedo fit it and all that, paid for everything. And I was just too drunk to get on the plane. I already told you what I do when I screw something up. I don't apologize. You go on that list. And every time Ethan would call, I couldn't answer the phone. I'd get that knot in my gut. You know, it just gets tighter and tighter, and I think, oh, gosh, it's him again. And then I heard they had a child, and then I heard they had another child, and I heard how nice the wife was. I mean, it just was getting worse and worse and worse. And I called, and I gave him how you guys taught me to do the ninth step. You know, I said, I'm on a life and death errand here, Ethan. I know you don't want to talk to me. I need 5 minutes of your time so that I don't ever have to drink again. I'm doing this thing called the ninth step where I have to at least try to straighten out the wreckage of my past. Can you give me 5 minutes, maybe with you and your dad? And he said, yes, you could be here at 8 a.m. on Saturday if you can make it. That was 9 years later. So he remembered. And I got up early at, you know, 4 in the morning. I did the 3-hour drive. I get there. I'm 10, 15 minutes early. Got a pocket full of money. I knock on the door. Ethan opens the door. I see his parents' car was out front, and I see his wife standing by the kitchen counter. She's with a daughter there. I see his mother and father in the back. What I didn't see was this little boy, man. He came darting from somewhere. The one thing I knew is how he'd been telling his wife, you know, about what a no good drunken bum his friend Rich is, and these kids, what a bum I am. This little boy comes running out of nowhere, grabs a hold of my leg like a tree trunk. He looked up at me and he said, "You're my Uncle Rich? Daddy said one day I'd meet you." And page 78, our book talks about 9 out of 10 times when a man is approached in this fashion, you know, the unexpected happens. And what happened for me is it became real clear to me right then and there that who would deliberately manufacture their own misery? I'm the one that puts up the wall between me and you. You know, my ego, my inability to walk through my own ego, to admit any type of fault, I missed out on years of those kids' lives. They didn't hate me. He didn't tell them what a bum I was. They told him they had an Uncle Rich that they'd meet someday. I kept me from them. The other part of that is I now, every Christmas Eve, I go with my family, and then I go over there with presents for those kids. I show up for their birthdays. When it snows, I do the 3-hour drive to take them sleigh riding. They look at me, you know how kids are. They say, "Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days like it's an accident," you know? And that's cool with me because AA's taught me to show up on all the good days. I sat down, I went and talked to his father in the other room, told him about the ninth step. I said, "I know I owe you some money for the tuxedo, plane ticket. What do I owe you? How can I make this right? You tell me, I'll do it." He said, "You owe me $1,372. I start to get out the money. I didn't see that coming either. But he said, no. "If you're really a part of this Alcoholics Anonymous thing you're talking about, what you're going to do is you're going to pay me back that money no more than $10 at a time. You're going to take some donuts to that home group of yours you say you have. You're going to take some extra coffee cups if they need them. You're going to fill up a newcomer's car with $10 worth of gas. No more. Put the gas in the car. Don't give them the money. You're going to save every single $10 receipt. And when they equal $1,372, you're going to bring them back to me. And on that day, your amends will be complete." And by the way, Rich, I've been sober in AA for 28 years, and I've been praying for you and Ethan since you've been that big. We have a heck of a relationship today. Yeah. I'd cleared just about everything up in my life. Life was going pretty great. And you all even threw in the AA girlfriend. I was dating a young lady that had been sober for quite a while, and 17, 18 years at that point. And Roger looked at me and said, this is a good time for you to do your last one. You know, you got one left. And I had a warrant that I hadn't cleared up yet back in San Diego. I had a DUI with some outside issues in my pocket. And the judge, I went in front of him. They have a program in California called PC-1000. It's a felony diversion program. I was in college. He said, you know what, if you go to these 10 AA meetings, go to these five classes, get a urinalysis once a week for a month, or I forget what it was, but it was, looking back, it was relatively simple. I told that judge, he said, you know, if you do these things, this will not be on your record. I don't want to ruin your life. If you fail to complete these, I'm going to give you every day of the 5 years that this carries. Are we clear, Mr. Bruckner? And I said, yes, Your Honor, we are. You'll never see me again. I got it, you know. And I meant it. I had no idea that I couldn't complete anything like 10 meetings of AA. Woo, you know, you're asking, what an order. I can't go through with it. But, and I've already told you what I do. Once there's a warrant, I run, and I did, and years went by. My solutions for my problems are often worse than the original problem. So this thing snowballed. And I had to go do the 5 years. And Roger said, this is a great time for you to go do that 5 years. I did not think it was a great time to do that 5 years. This is why it's good to have a sponsor. They see things different. By this point, I'm pretty familiar with the book. I'm throwing some paragraphs at him from pages 79 and 80. We don't do these acts of heroics where we turn ourselves in. I'd be no use to anyone. My mom needs me. I'm good friends with my sister. You know, Allison and I live together. We got the house. I have this career doing the pools. And he said, well, let's start right there. First of all, you don't have a career, you do pools. Somebody else can do that. Second, you and Allison don't live in a house, you live in a trailer and you rent it, you don't own it. Third, your mother's been just fine without you for all those years, and that girl you're dating has been sober 17 years. She has a sponsor and a God that's taking care of her. They're all going to be just fine. This is a good time for you to go to prison. How free do you want to be? And he and two carloads of guys from my home group drove me to the airport. We have a men's meeting at my house, a men's big book meeting on Wednesdays. I was sponsoring a guy from New York at the time. He's dead now. He went back to drinking and it didn't work out. But he saved my life because his name was John, and he called himself Johnny the Chooch. And Chooch is like a New York word for a goofball. And the Chooch was at this Wednesday meeting when the guys were telling me, you know, we share with each other. It's what we're going to do and what's happening in our lives. You know, we stay current with each other, and they can have some input on our lives. And I said, you know, Roger wants me to go do this. I'm kind of scared. You know, what do you guys think? And throw Wayne in. And Johnny the Chooch looks at me and says, you kidding me? You got to go. You're my sponsor. And that stinks when a guy you sponsor looks at you, you know. And that's why I see AA like a train. And when you're in the middle of the train, I mean, the engine might crash into something and the caboose always falls off. But when you're that center car and you're following these guys that are ahead of you, and you got those guys locked in back of you, you don't often hear about the center car derailing. And Johnny the Chooch gave me that push. You know, you got to go. And I went out there. What I didn't know is the rest of the group had written letters. 47 letters went from you folks to that judge before I went there. And he said, basically, whatever you're doing back in Maryland, keep it up. I'm not locking you up here. I ask you to go to 10 meetings. They say you've been to over 1,000 meetings. Whatever you're doing back there in AA, I want you to have a good life, and I want you to keep it up. And I'll tell you, I went in that courtroom that morning. I had sweat circles under my arms. I'd been in and out of the bathroom 4 times, so any of this stuff about fear and faith can't be in the same place. I don't know what that is. Not my experience. I was scared to death, and I had some faith that it was going to work out one way or another. And I'd like to tell you that I did it, you know, courageously or something. I didn't. I know I came back out in the hallway. I was so excited. My God got a lot bigger that day. AA has given me, Bill talks in his story, at long last I saw, I felt, I believed, in that order. We get an experiential God in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you guys didn't sell me anything. You didn't convince me about yours. You told me to take simple actions that caused things to happen. When those things happened in my life, it became undeniable, and I had a God based upon personal experience. And I called Roger, and I said, Roger, tell the guys, I'm coming home. And he said, whoa, what do you mean? And I said, I'm coming home. He didn't lock me up. And he said, well, that's great. And, I mean, I'm excited about this. I'm so excited. I still have the home ticket in the front of my big book, one way from San Diego home. But he said, wait a second. You can't come home until tomorrow. There's no way. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You can't get a ticket home until tomorrow. Why don't you go over to that Jesuit school that kicked you out and try to make right with them while you're there? And I'm going, wait a second. Like, can I get a minute to breathe? You know, this guy's like it. But so I go over there, and it seemed like kind of small potatoes after the 5 years. I met with the dean of the school. It turned out being the same dean that had kicked me out. And I said, I don't know if you remember me. My name's Rich Bruckner. She said, oh, I remember. And I said, I now know what the Jesuits are. I know you all stand for Building Men of Integrity, Education. I wasn't any of that. I've let you guys down on so many levels and brought so much shame to this institution. I don't have any idea how to make it right, but as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't ever want to have to take another drink. Anything you tell me to do to make this right, I'll do it. She said, come with me. Walked me into a building I'd never been in, took out a bunch of papers, and said, I want you to fill this out. This is an application to our law school. What you're going to do is you're going to apply, you're going to go to our law school, you're going to graduate from our law school, and you're going to make us proud. That's what you could do to make this right. We don't like to kick people out. That doesn't make us look good. What makes us look good is people graduating. I stepped outside. I called Roger. I said, Roger, listen to this. This woman's lost her mind. I've been arrested 36 times. She wants me to go to law school. I'm not a very good student. Even if I graduate from law school, they're not going to let me take the bar exam. I've been federally arrested. I have those other 35 small ones. Even if I pass the bar exam, the ethics committee is never going to let me practice law. He said, hey, shut up. Did you just tell that lady you'd do whatever she said to make right? And I said, yes, I did. He said, go inside and fill out the paperwork. And I did. All I can tell you is I have no idea how it happened. I went to that law school the way that I come to AA and the way you guys taught me to live life. I showed up a half hour early for each class. I put my hand out to each and every teacher. They knew my name personally like a newcomer would walking through the door at my home group. I asked a question if I didn't have one, just to make conversation like we do with the newcomer. I graduated from the top of my class at that school, and I'm not a smart cat by any stretch. I came out of there, came home. I got the best job that a guy right out of law school could get. I got a clerkship for 2 circuit court judges, the highest judges in the state of Maryland. And I wish you all could have been there for the interview. It was funny. I had all these great recommendations. I'd been sober for a while. And they said, gosh, you know, you have all these wonderful recommendations, but we pulled your NCIC background report, and you've got these 36 arrests. What's going on? And I said, well, you all know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to disclose that to you in the disclosure. I'm not sure how familiar you are with AA. There's a substantial period of drinking required for membership. And they just started laughing like you guys. So I think I think God put me in front of the right guys on the right day. I shared that with my mother, my sister, my home group, my sponsor. The last things I want to share with you is another spiritual principle I learned about our ninth step. Our ninth step is our opportunity to clean up the wreckage of our past, or the wreckage of our past will clean us up. It can happen one way or the other, but it's going to happen. They called me back in there. They sent the paperwork off to Annapolis. I wasn't supposed to start the job for 6 months. That's our state capital. They sent the paperwork back. The judges called me into their office. I said, what's up? What's going on, guys? And they said, we can't hire you. We just got the paperwork back from Annapolis. You have 3 felony warrants out of the state of Colorado. You're a fugitive. And wasn't on my 4th step, wasn't on my 8th step, wasn't on my 9th step. More will be revealed. I said, guys, I've been honest with you about everything. You see how hard I've worked to be here, right now with you guys in this room. Can I have a chance to take care of this? This isn't supposed to start for 6 months. Can I please try to straighten this out? And if I do, in this time frame, can I still have the job? They looked at each other and they said, we just hired a guy that's been arrested 36 times. What's 37? And I went to Colorado. I worked for an employer in Colorado. He paid me based on my performance, which was getting worse. I didn't recognize that. So when he failed to pay me what I thought I deserved, I supplemented my income with a couple checks. They call that felony check fraud. I had three of those. I had a chance to make that right with that gentleman. As I was making my amends, I told him what I was doing. He stopped me and said, whoa, you're on the ninth step of Alcoholics Anonymous? I've never made it past three. And we had a two-hour AA talk. And I got to make that amends and came back and told the judges what happened. And they said the job can be yours. In the meantime, and this is the meantime, which is God's time because it's not my time because I can't set things like this up, and I have no idea how it happens, my phone rang. I answered the phone. On the other end of the phone was some guy that said he was the state's attorney for the state of Maryland and that he just got a federal grant and that they have been trying to get this together. They wanted to start a narcotics and gang task force to prosecute drug dealers that are gang related, and he'd been given my name as somebody that knew something about the importation of narcotics. And would I be interested in serving him as the assistant state's attorney for the state of Maryland and heading up the gang and narcotics unit? What went through my mind was our book and those old dogs, man, all those old guys that said, one day your sordid past will become your greatest asset. I've done that for 3.5 years to date today. Turns out that thanks to you guys, I'm a really good trial lawyer. I'm a really good prosecutor of drug dealers. They have a hard time lying to me. I have a lot of fun with it when I go to work. It was embarrassing at first. I will tell you, the first month I had some moments. I mean, I felt like, you know, I didn't belong there. That I would come in, the judge in the morning would say, would the defendant please rise? And I'd stand up and he'd say, sit down. And I'd sit down and I'd turn red. And I eventually, you know, got the hang of it. And I get to come in contact with a lot of us, that are doing what they need to do to get the next drink. Some people see a criminal where sometimes I just see an alcoholic, and I have a chance to talk to them eyeball to eyeball. The way that this thing begins, you know, one alcoholic to another, because that's what I am before I'm anything else. You know, the other stuff's what I get to do as the result of what I be, which is an alcoholic. Prayer and meditation has led me all kinds of different places, and it's something I love. And trying to carry this message, I have a lot of fun. Our book says it's something you don't want to miss. I want to tell one quick story about a guy that I work with named Drew, because sometimes I like to think that I have something to do with sponsoring these guys and the outcomes and all that kind of stuff. And I get tied up and I get sad when they get drunk, or if they have a success, I feel like, you know, maybe I had something to do with it. And that's just ego, one way or the other. But Drew was a retired merchant marine. He got these monthly pension checks that were ungodly enormous. He couldn't run out of money no matter how bad he messed up the month before. And he told me that he had this idea that he was going to take a sailboat. He was going to cash it all in, get on a sailboat from Annapolis and go down to Boca del Toro, Panama, anchor this baby up and live out the rest of his days like Jimmy Buffett. And I'm thinking that this ought to be good. He's got about 5 months sober, and we finally just got him through the steps. You've lost your mind is what I'm thinking. But I also know from Roger, you know, you don't say a word. I'm not a life coach. I view my job as actually Bill Wilson gave the instruction that a sponsor's job is an adequate presentation of the steps. That's it. You know, I'm not a life coach. I'm not a relationship coach. Maybe if I know something about some of that, I don't know. But Drew was through the steps. I did suggest he go check it out and find some AA. He came back and said that there's no AA. He tried to get some going. They were having a hard time with the big book in English. He didn't know that we printed it in Spanish. I showed him we ordered a case of Spanish big books from New York. And I went with him to Annapolis, and we packed up this sailboat with all of Drew's life belongings and a case of Spanish big books. And off he went. And I thought to myself, you know, never see him again. And I didn't hear anything from him for about 3 years, and I just assumed he was drunk and maybe died down there because I'd been to Panama. It's not a good place to be a drunk. I was having a less than great day at work, and my phone rang, and it was a weird phone number, and I picked it up, and on the other end of that phone went, hola, me llamo Juan, yo soy alcoholico. passed the phone to some guy that said, Me llamo Ricardo, yo soy alcoholico. Passed the phone to some guy that said, Me llamo Esteban, yo soy alcoholico. This went on for about 4 minutes. Talked to 20-some people. I couldn't figure out what in the world was going on. The last guy that gets on that phone is Drew. He says, Hey, it's Drew. You just talked to the Boca del Toro group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd have lost every penny I own betting on that guy. But I'll tell you that every day of my life, I get to say two great things as a result of what you all have given me. Each morning in that courtroom, I get to stand up and I say, Good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. Every night, I get to come hang out with you folks, and I get to say that my name is Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for my life. That's all I got.